Another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Ken Kuminski, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Thursday, August 27th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first article, the Russia-Ukraine war has entered a new deadlier phase. Both countries are inflicting mounting destruction with long-range drones and missiles. By Marcus Walker. A Russian barrage of missiles and drones hit a children's hospital, a school, apartments, and warehouses around Kyiv last week, killing at least 16 people. Ukraine, lacking Patriot interceptors, didn't shoot down any of Russia's ballistic missiles. Ukraine's response this week included a drone strike that caused a massive fire at one of Russia's largest oil refineries near Nizhny Novgorod on Wednesday. Meanwhile, in the central Russian region of Tambov, a warehouse belonging to e-commerce giant Wildberries burned. The air war between Russia and Ukraine has entered a new phase. With expanded aerial arsenals and inadequate air defenses, both sides are bludgeoning each other in a bare-knuckle fight that is causing a widening swath of destruction and a rising civilian toll. Moscow is betting that it can crush the will of Ukraine's civilian population, giving it the breakthrough that has eluded its army in eastern Ukraine. Kyiv is trying to make Russia's invasion unsustainable by crippling the industries that underpin its economy. Yet neither side appears to be close to breaking. The war is getting more ruthless and destructive, but no closer to ending. Russian President Vladimir Putin threatened to expand the range of targets in Ukraine in response to Kyiv's strikes on its oil industry. The Kyiv regime set out to damage our economy. What did it do? It opened this Pandora's box itself, he said last week. Russia's strategy of pain. Russia's and Ukraine's long-range air campaigns both use drones and missiles, but their strategies are different. Russia began a systematic campaign against Ukraine's energy infrastructure in the fall of 2022, when its invasion had stalled and its army had suffered a series of setbacks. Moscow pivoted to plunging Ukrainian cities into cold and darkness as winter approached. For four winters in succession, it hasn't worked. Ukrainians have managed to defend, repair, or replace enough of their heating and electricity supply to keep their cities going. But each year, the cumulative damage to Ukraine's energy grid has grown. The lack of Patriot interceptors in short supply globally since the U.S.-Iran war is darkening the mood in Kyiv. Russia's long-range strikes have killed hundreds of Ukrainian civilians this summer, with Iskander-M ballistic missiles doing much of the killing. Many residents of Kyiv fear Russia will try to destroy the city's water and sewage systems as Moscow looks for new ways to create a humanitarian crisis. Some in Kyiv are discussing whether to move temporarily to the countryside if conditions in the capital get too bad this winter. Few believe Russia will achieve victory this way. The theory is that pain plus exhaustion produces political capitulation, said Franz Stefan Gaddy, a Vienna-based military analyst and head of Gaddy Consulting. But experience since 2022, and a century of strategic bombing before that, say sustained air attack hardens societies rather than breaking them. And there is nothing in the Ukrainian data suggesting otherwise, he said. Surveys suggest the Ukrainian public has become more opposed in recent months to making territorial concessions to Moscow. Hunting missile launchers. Russia's strikes have failed to stop the rapid growth of Ukraine's defense technology sector, which is now churning out millions of drones a year in decentralized and well-hidden facilities. With only a trickle of Patriot interceptors arriving from Western allies, Ukraine is working on other ways to disrupt Russia's missile salvos. Ukrainian drones have been destroying air defenses in neighboring regions of southern Russia, potentially paving the way for a larger scale effort to hunt down Russian missile launchers, including for their relatively short-range Iskander MIZ. If the airspace is cluttered with drones, it could force missile launchers to hide or push them further back, said Rob Lee, a Kyiv-based military analyst and a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. It's not a 100% solution, but it could make things more difficult for Russia. Ballistic missiles aren't the only threat, Lee noted. Russia is building up its arsenal of jet-powered drones, such as the Garand 5, based on the Iranian Shahed and the relatively low-cost Banderol cruise missile. Both are cheaper than regular missiles, allowing for large-scale production, and could further stretch Ukraine's air defenses, he said. The Tsar unmoved. Ukraine's long-range capabilities have risen dramatically over the past year. Its deep strike campaign has widened from oil refineries, energy export infrastructure, and missile component factories to Black Sea shipping and the warehouses of Russia's biggest e-commerce chains, Wildberries and Ozon. The strikes are killing civilians, although not on the same scale as Russia's. Kyiv's declared aims are to hit military supply chains, cut off the export revenue that fund Moscow's war machine, and cause widening economic disruption that makes the war visible to Russia's population. Yet most observers of Russia doubt that discontent among the country's population or its business elite will move Putin to accept a ceasefire. He is betting he can suppress dissent and that the economy can absorb the pain for longer than Ukraine can. The effects of the long-range strike campaign on Russian society and the Russian economy would have to get a lot worse for it to be anywhere close to changing Putin's calculus, said Hannah Note, a Russia expert at the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies in Monterey, California. Although a few Russian analysts have said recently that Moscow can't achieve its war aims in Ukraine, they were less driven by the effects of the long-range strike campaign and more worried about the lack of movement at the front, said Knott. The decisive variable in the war remains military manpower, said Gaddy, including whether Putin will launch a large-scale mobilization in the coming months to redouble its ground campaign. Long-range strike is what both sides do because it is the one domain where they can still act when the ground war is stalemated, he said. It will get steadily more destructive without being decisive. And next, the connections that turned a precocious teen into the fallen Nostradamus of AI. A 24-year-old inventor was hailed as a visionary and attracted billions before turning into Wall Street's latest cautionary tale. By Berber Jin, Ben Cohen, and Anissa Gardizi. For the past few years, at happy hours and dinner parties in San Francisco, Leopold Eschenbrenner kept confusing people by sharing his favorite outlandish idea. He wanted to buy galaxies. Some of his friends weren't always sure what to make of Eschenbrenner's intergalactic ambitions. He once left the room and they debated whether he was referring to physical galaxies or a type of private plane. No, he assured them when he came back, he meant galaxies. His idea was that advances in artificial intelligence would soon unlock resources on a cosmic scale, enabling humans to colonize faraway planets. He planned to save money now so he could spend on galaxies, he told them, and make his mark across the universe. To almost everyone in this world, outside the AI bubble of Silicon Valley, the idea of scooping up property rights outside of Earth might sound improbable. But in Ashenbrenner's world, that sort of fervent belief was among the reasons the 24-year-old investor was hailed as a visionary. Since graduating from Columbia University in 2021 as the class valedictorian at age 19, he has worked his way into the upper echelons of technology. He spent time working out of now convicted crypto founder Sam Bankman-Fried's compound in the Bahamas, and then at OpenAI in San Francisco. Even as he drew attention as a troublemaker among some of his bosses, according to people who worked with him, he grew close to the industry's top players. 2 years ago, he made bold predictions about the impending arrival of superintelligence, writing in a 165-page manifesto called Situational Awareness that AI would lead to one of the most intense and volatile moments of human history. He quickly turned that interest into money for a hedge fund that eventually managed $45 billion in assets, backed by investors who believed in his prophecy or his ability to profit from it. He was barely of drinking age and had no prior investing experience, but his cozy relationships inside the industry fed into his reputation as an oracle of AI, someone who knew more about where the elusive technology was headed than legacy money managers living in New York. He mixed the personal and professional in a city where the two are rarely kept apart. There are perhaps a few hundred people, most of them in San Francisco, and the AI labs that have situational awareness, he wrote in his viral essay. Through whatever peculiar forces of fate, I have found myself amongst them. When Ashenbrenner's hedge fund unraveled last month, veterans on Wall Street saw it as the latest cautionary tale of hubris, another inexperienced, overconfident investor taking on too much risk with far too much leverage. Securities regulators are also investigating the trading activity of his fund, Situational Awareness, though they haven't made any formal allegations of wrongdoing. We are a highly regulated business and will cooperate to the fullest extent with any regulatory request, the company has said. But in Silicon Valley, Ashenbrenner's stature has only grown among the elite group of researchers and executives that share his zealotry in a future dominated by AI. From his mansion tucked away in San Francisco's rolling hills and an office downtown, he has entertained well-connected guests and grew particularly close to employees at the AI giant Anthropic. Many of them were at his wedding earlier this month, when Ashenbrenner married the chief of staff to Anthropic CEO Dario Amodei. The guest list included Amodei himself, plus the company's top scientists and other key executives, as well as AI luminaires and members of the Silicon Valley elite. But by the time he walked down the aisle, Ashenbrenner's fund was in tatters. 2 days earlier, Situational Awareness had blown up. A tall poppy. Only a decade ago, Leopold Ashenbrenner was desperate to come to America. Growing up in Berlin, he collected academic awards and distinguished himself as one of the country's brightest young scientific minds. He was also politically engaged, speaking at the National Convention of the Green Party as a teenager. But he felt out of place at home, attributing his desire to leave Germany to his country's tall poppy syndrome, the idea that successful people get criticized and cut down. They really, really, really hate anyone that deviates from the norm, he said in a 2021 podcast. He started college at Columbia when he was only 15 years old. Professors remember him as one of the most brilliant undergraduate they ever met. Classmates remember him for getting into heated debates about ancient texts and the scientific method. While he blogged about students wasting time watching Netflix, he found something else to binge that would end up being far more important to his career: effective altruism. Eschenbrenner grew interested in the ideas behind the philosophical movement, which aims to apply data and reason to maximize good in the world. One focus is how to reduce longer-term risks that people typically ignore, including AI that could go rogue and declare war on humans. After his sophomore year, Eschenbrenner went to Oxford for a summer internship at the Future of Humanity Institute, which was affiliated with EA. Eschenbrenner spent his days in a drab office building alongside theorists who worried about extinction issues, like the probability of asteroid strikes, and worked on a paper that examined whether economic growth increased the risk of global catastrophe. Returning to campus that fall, Eschenbrenner passed out flyers for the Columbia Effective Altruism Club at the school activities fair with his friend Colin Burns, whom he met when they were competitive Rubik's cubers. Eschenbrenner says he is not an effective altruist. They soon organized the club outing to watch Scottish philosopher Will McCaskill, whose ideas drove the EA movement, deliver a Saturday night lecture called The Ethics of the Next Billion Years, promising to order takeout with plenty of vegetarian and vegan options. That school year, Eschenbrenner watched in utter despair as the pandemic shut down campus. "All I could do was buy masks," he later wrote, "and short the market." When he graduated in 2021, he wasn't sure what to do next. After earning a nearly perfect LSAT score that he shared on his LinkedIn page, Eschenbrenner was accepted to Yale Law School and seriously considered the offer, aspiring to become a Supreme Court judge. Instead of going to law school, he went into a radically different direction to the Bay Area to find the true American spirit. He said on a podcast in 2024, "I had to come out here." Within a few months of graduating, Eschenbrenner was in a group chat with Sam Bankman-Fried to discuss contacts in the Bahamian government, as the founder of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX was headed to Bitcoin mining farm in Kazakhstan. Eschenbrenner had joined the FTX Future Fund, a philanthropy backed primarily by Bankman-Fried. The fund had a lofty goal of giving away up to $1 billion in 2022 alone, doing as much good as we can for the future of the world. Among its top priorities was AI safety. Future Fund was run by a small band of effective altruists that included McCaskill, the philosopher, and Avital Balwit, Eschenbrenner's future wife. She had recently turned down a Rhodes Scholarship and managed a failed House campaign for a Democratic candidate funded by Bankman-Fried. Their work put Eschenbrenner in proximity to the crypto tycoon himself, then one of the world's youngest billionaires. Eschenbrenner stayed in the Bahamas with Balwit in the 600-acre luxury resort that FTX executives call home. In a sixth-floor penthouse, the Future Fund team met with Bankman-Fried and the confidants who would later testify against him. The effective altruists spent hours debating how to be most effectively altruistic. Eschenbrenner and Bankman-Fried were also in 17 group chats together on the encrypted messaging app Signal, according to documents from Bankman-Fried's trial, including conversations named EI Discussion and Anthropic Chat. In 2021, Bankman-Fried agreed to buy a roughly 8% stake in the AI startup for $500 million. Going viral. Eschenbrenner formulated the worldview behind his paper called Situational Awareness: The Decade Ahead while he was still at OpenAI. He spent time quizzing colleagues for insights into OpenAI's future strategy and says some said he struck them as particularly interested in the company's plans for securing computing power. The notes that he wrote up synthesizing his thoughts would form the basis of his viral manifesto. He launched his fund with a nearly five-hour appearance on a hit podcast hosted by his friend Dwarkesh Patel. They drew close after Patel benefited from a small but pivotal grant from Future Fund early in his podcasting career. These days, they share office space. Eschenbrenner brought on a veteran of the EA movement, former hedge fund investor Carl Shulman, to run the fund with him. They eventually won over Jane Street, the EA-tinged trading firm that rarely allocates capital to outside managers. They also took investment from Silicon Valley heavyweights like Stripe co-founders Patrick and John Collison. The fund loaded up on public companies across the AI supply chain, semiconductors, energy, software. It also invested in private companies. The crown jewel of the portfolio was a stake in Anthropic, where Eschenbrenner briefly considered trying to get a job after he left OpenAI. And as a reminder, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. How about this from the lifestyle section? The new cure for career burnout, clown school. For actors and others worn down by rejection and the pressure to get everything right, clowning offers an unusual prescription, Embrace Failure, by Grace Yoon. For months, the running joke at Philippe Goulier's famed clown school outside of Paris was that Jack Grossman was going to die alone. Then Grossman was paired with Zoe Wolfeld and instructed to imitate boiling milk. The pair dragged a white sheet onto the stage, climbed underneath, and jumped up and down. Goulier snorted, a rare sign of approval from the exacting clown instructor, who was known for his blunt critiques and caustic insults. Not long after, Grossman and Wolfeld began dating. Today, they produce and perform clown shows around the globe together. Clowning, a method of actor training built around vulnerability, spontaneity, and play, is opening a new world for a new generation. No longer just the realm of circus performers with red noses and horror figures like Pennywise, it's become an antidote for actors and others tired of rejection and the pressure to get everything right. Wolfeld was a Shakespearean theater actress. Grossman was a chemistry major at the University of California, Los Angeles, who did stand-up comedy on the side. Neither expected to wind up at clown school. Frustrated by the rigidity of classical theater, Wolfeld was searching for a different way to perform. Grossman realized he no longer wanted a career in science. They abandoned their respective paths in 2022 and enrolled at Goulier's school, which operates under the philosophy that theater is as serious as a children's game. Clowning relies on direct engagement with an audience. Rather than disappearing into a character, performers respond to the room in real time, using physical comedy, improvisation, and audience reaction to build out the show. It requires imagination and a willingness to fail big. Goulier, who died in February, taught students that wasn't working rather than prescribing what to do. And like any good clown, he did it with exaggerated aplomb, vigorously pounding a small drum when he found a performance lacking. Students came to dread that sound. He was playing a character that was like a very crotchety old man who hated everything, Grossman said, and he played it very well. Exercises often push students into strange scenarios, embodying an object, exploring a feeling or inhabiting a logic to find more instinctive present performances. Most ended with the sound of Gaulier's drum, but they offered important life lessons. Students learned to take criticism, embrace failure, and return to the stage. Kylie Rolinchik recalled one game in which the instructor chose songs for the students to lip sync. Rolinchik was assigned a slow French ballad and was mortified when the instructor said she was doing too much. My ego was death rattling at that point. But what felt humiliating in the moment became liberating. It's almost like something dies and falls away, she said, and then you're a little bit freer. Rolinchik is now a communications specialist. Clowning is still a big part of her life. She works as a healthcare clown for Boston Children's Hospital on the side and continues to live by the clowning code. Be open-minded and take life with a spoonful of levity. Lex Alston stumbled on clowning when required to take a physical education course at SUNY Purchase College. The physical performance felt more expansive than any of the roles they'd encountered in theater. Alston is now a professional circus clown. When Julia Proctor was rejected from New York University's Tisch grad acting program, the admissions officers told her they were looking for more impulsive, messier actors. Their advice? Study clowning. It changed the course of her career. Proctor, who studied theater and political science in college, now teaches three classes on clowning at NYU and is the founder of Clown Gym, a New York City studio focused on all things physical comedy. Clown is so much about embracing failure and vulnerability and acknowledging that you don't have control over your life, she said. Everyone from corporate attorneys to therapists have taken Proctor's classes, and the workshops sell out quickly. Therapists sometimes even recommend their patients take clowning. But Yale drama professor Christopher Bays has a warning for those expecting his clowning classes to function as a form of treatment. It can be deeply therapeutic, but it's not therapy. It's not medicine, he said. Danielle Smith, a union leader, discovered clowning after falling down an internet rabbit hole. She gave Clown Gym a shot. I remember telling my friends I'm going to this basement in Midtown to learn clown, and them be kind of like, okay, yeah, that actually sounds like something you would do, she said. The skills she developed in those classes, staying present, embracing vulnerability, and reading a room, have carried into her workplace relationships. Clowning even has a line in her resume. Her colleagues and friends say clowning aligns with Smith's natural curiosity and playfulness. The one downside? They now have to think twice before using clown as an insult. And now, from the automobile topic section, Detroit needs Canada more than rest of the U.S. does. Trump threatens escalated tariffs on vehicles imported from Canada to 50%, adding chaos to industry challenged by trade wars, by Ryan Felton and Christopher Otts. The reignited trade war between the U.S. and its northern neighbor hit a fever pitch this week after President Trump proclaimed, "We don't need Canada, they need us." The American auto industry, however, views things differently. Detroit's carmakers, in particular, could see some of their most profitable products walloped if Trump follows through on a threat to double tariffs on cars and auto parts from Canada to 50% from 25%. Stellantis assembles the Chrysler brand's popular Pacifica minivan just across the border in Windsor, Ontario. General Motors produces pickup trucks at a factory in Oshawa, Ontario. Ford is set to begin making F-Series Super Duty trucks later this year at a plant near Toronto and Oakville, in addition to at a factory in Kentucky. and Ford and GM each produced engines in Canada for trucks and SUVs sold in the U.S. Canada, the U.S.'s second largest trading partner, accounted for 8% of North American vehicle production in 2025, according to industry data provider Omdia. While that is down from about 13% a decade ago, as jobs and production have moved to Mexico and the U.S., the country remains a key maker of cars and parts, not to mention a buyer of them. Canada is the biggest export market for larger American trucks. UBS analysts said Honda and Toyota would be most exposed to increased tariffs, with Canadian imports accounting for roughly one out of every 10 vehicles the companies sell in the U.S. Automakers for now view the January 1st deadline set by Trump as a sign that the higher levies are less a threat and more of a negotiating tactic with Canada. People familiar with the company's thinking say, most are waiting to see how the talks develop before considering reassessing their production strategies, the people said. Ford, Stellantis, Honda, Toyota, and GM declined to comment. Still, there is reason for concern. Stephen Beattie, a former vice president at Toyota's Canada division, said one of Canada's most effective responses would be to ratchet up tariffs on full-size U.S. pickups, such as Ford's F-150, if Trump follows through with his threat. Canada is not without its options here, Beattie said. Hopefully we don't get to that point. Thomas Kowal, chief executive of Michigan auto parts maker Legera Technologies, said his company could benefit from the proposed tariffs since its magnesium parts compete with aluminum from Canada. My greater concern is the broader manufacturing industry, Kowal said, citing years of disruptions from the COVID pandemic, inflation, and tariffs. I worry about how much additional pressure the industry can absorb. The prospect of tariffs doubling on vehicle imports from Canada also is happening amid talks of overhauling the North American trade deal, known as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA, a pact that is crucial to the U.S. auto industry's day-to-day business. We urge U.S. and Canadian negotiators to reach a deal that enhances North American auto competitiveness and brings about a successful USMCA review, said Matt Blunt, head of the American Automotive Policy Council, a trade group that represents GM, Ford, and Stellantis. Trump first hit Canadian imports with tariffs, including steel and vehicles, early in his second term, prompting Canada to levy retaliatory duties on American-made cars and metal products. Cars and parts from Canada, which cross borders several times before being put inside a vehicle, are currently subject to a 25% tariff with some relief on parts that comply with stringent USMCA requirements. Detroit's automakers have responded to tariff ups and downs by planning to onshore production of certain vehicles and parts to the U.S. Most recently, Stellantis has indicated it is eyeing the sale of a Toronto-area factory following pressure from Trump for companies to relocate more operations to the U.S., a union representing Canada's auto workers said this month. However, moving auto production from one factory to another is neither quick nor easy. Reshoring efforts can take years, a daunting prospect when tariff rates fluctuate often. Barclays analyst Dan Levy said that Canadian production accounts for about 6% of U.S. auto sales, so a 50% tariff on vehicles is likely manageable. But a key question remains on whether parts compliant with the USMCA, the Trilateral Trade Pact, would continue to be exempt from levies, Levy wrote in a note Monday. We believe there is a significant lack of clarity on this point. The U.S. declined to renew the USMCA in July, prompting a review of the trade pact. Trump then threatened to hit $20 billion worth of Canadian goods with 50% tariffs, in part to force the Canadian government to the negotiating table. Trump said last week that a deal was close that would result in tariffs on Canadian vehicles dropping to 15%. However, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney said talks fell apart after U.S. officials sought to deny tariff relief to medium and heavy-duty vehicles, which would make the country's auto industry less competitive over time. United Auto Workers President Sean Fain, a supporter of Trump's existing automotive tariffs, said the latest threat against Canada is misguided and suggested tougher trade action against other countries. If we're going to increase tariffs anywhere, it should be on countries where automakers continue to offshore jobs because they can pay workers $3 an hour, force them to work in unsafe conditions, and crack down on independent unions, Fain said Tuesday. Warren Brown, an industry consultant, said car sales would likely fall next year if the tariff increase goes into effect, assuming automakers respond with increases in sticker prices and shipping charges. The U.S. and Canada will both face serious hardship if this scenario becomes policy, Brown, a former GM executive, said Tuesday in a note. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The time is now 36 minutes past the hour. And here's an article about that finicky topic, oil prices. Oil prices fall as Oman-Iran talks raise hopes for Hormuz reopening. Brent crude for October delivery fell 2.5% to $86.38 a barrel, while WTI dropped 2.2% to $80.53 after earlier trading below $80, by Joe Stonor. Oil prices fell for a third straight day after Iran and Oman discussed measures to temporarily reopen the Strait of Hormuz. In early U.S. trade, Brent crude oil for October delivery fell 2.5% to $86.38 a barrel, while West Texas Intermediate dropped 2.2% to $80.53 a barrel after earlier trading below the $80 mark. The contracts are on track to settle at their lowest levels in close to 2 weeks. The drops come after Oman and Iran said the country's foreign ministers discussed an agreement to reopen the Strait of Hormuz under a temporary framework. In a joint statement following talks in Tehran, the pair said a proposed framework would establish a temporary shipping route through the crucial waterway. The countries would also work together to clear the Strait of mines, they said. President Trump had said in a Truth Social post Tuesday that the U.S. Navy had removed or detonated all mines in the strait, though some analysts doubt the president's claim. Negotiations between the two countries will continue with a view to agreeing on a permanent navigational corridor and a future administration of the strait, the joint statement said. While positive, an agreement between Oman and Iran wouldn't result in oil flows through the strait returning to pre-war levels, ING analysts Warren Patterson and Iwa Manthi said. We would likely need to see the U.S. lift its blockade on Iranian ports and ease sanctions on Iran before we see any move towards normalization. Meanwhile, a flurry of positive headlines raised hopes for diplomatic progress in the region. Axios reported that around 40 ships transited the strait over the weekend, while the New York Times reported U.S. diplomats would return to the Middle East. You can have it your way with this article, How Burger King Revamped Its Whopper and Overtook Wendy's, by Heather Haddon. To overhaul its signature Whopper, Burger King added a more premium bun, new mayonnaise, a box to preserve freshness, and a corporate chef who had already worked magic at chicken chain Popeyes. Overseen by Burger King's U.S. head chef, Amy Alarcon, who developed the Popeye's chicken sandwich that became a viral sensation in 2019, the revamped Whopper is now helping propel a comeback for the chain. Burger King has lately been drawing diners at a swifter rate than both McDonald's and Wendy's, and its restaurant sales are growing faster. After struggling for years, Burger King is gaining momentum in a rocky patch for the fast food industry. Inflation-fatigued consumers are watching their food dollars and eating more at home, while restaurants strain under rising costs, particularly for beef. A lot of people are saying they're coming back for the first time in a long time, Tom Curtis, president of the chain's U.S. and Canada business, said in an interview. Known for its flame-grilled beef, Burger King has struggled for years with outdated restaurants and menu mistakes, like a hand-breaded chicken sandwich that was hard to make. Several large franchise groups declared bankruptcy as their profits declined and hundreds of locations closed. Restaurant Brands International, Burger King's parent, has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to reverse traffic declines, helping franchises upgrade restaurants with ordering kiosks and digital menu boards while expanding marketing. Earlier this month, Burger King reported an 8.5% increase in U.S. same-store sales over its most recent quarter, beating McDonald's results by the largest margin in at least 2 years. Wendy's U.S. same-store sales declined by 7%. Burger King topped both of its main rivals in visit growth in July, according to Placer.ai, which analyzes foot traffic. Burger King has reclaimed the number two spot among U.S. burger chains, bumping aside Wendy's in terms of U.S. sales over the 12 months ending June 30th, company filings show. Curtis himself has played a starring role in the turnaround effort, featuring in videos on Burger King's social media accounts where he encourages customers to call him directly with suggestions or complaints. The company said he has personally taken 3,000 calls. Roland and Wendy. McDonald's remains the U.S. burger leader, generating roughly five times the domestic sales of Burger King and wielding a billion-dollar ad budget. Wendy's, which had held the number two spot by sales since 2020, isn't far behind Burger King in total U.S. sales, despite having hundreds of fewer locations. McDonald's and Wendy's franchised U.S. restaurants also tend to have better margins than Burger King's. Burger King's average U.S. franchisee profit last year dropped to around $185,000 per location, down from roughly $205,000 in 2023 and 2024, which executives have attributed in part to record beef prices. Both chains are redoubling their own efforts. McDonald's, which has reported sluggish sales growth in recent months and declining traffic, earlier this month appointed a new president of its U.S. operations, Sky Anderson. Anderson aims to better focus the business and rally Golden Arches franchisees behind a new corporate strategy promising better food and service, including enhanced training. In an internal video to U.S. restaurant operators, Anderson said that she wanted the company to move faster and that she would be visible, transparent, and direct with franchisees. "You've shared concerns about performance, increasing complexity, and an enormous pressure many restaurants are feeling today," Anderson said in the video, a copy of which was viewed by the Wall Street Journal. At Wendy's, recently appointed Chief Executive Bob Wright has been traveling the country to meet with franchisees, laying out a five-point plan covering food, branding, operations, restaurants, and digital strategy. He has also held online forums with operators talking about the need to improve quality and offer better value options. "We're in the early stages of this work, and meaningful change won't happen overnight," Wright said in an August 7th investor call. Wright said he was conducting a top-to-bottom review of Wendy's, and he slashed the company's dividend to invest in the business. Investor Nelson Peltz, a longtime Wendy's shareholder, is adding to the pressure. Peltz's Trian Fund Management has been exploring a deal to take the chain private. Deal deluge. Burger chains have leaned on value menus to try to boost traffic. McDonald's kicked off the recent promotional blitz in 2024 with a series of meal deals starting at $5. Since then, the chain has added more deals, including buy one, get one for a dollar, lower-priced meal combos, and an under $3 menu. Wendy's earlier this year introduced new $4, $6, and $8 tiers to its Biggie Bag deals. But in recent weeks, executives at both Wendy's and McDonald's said they were rethinking how they approach deals after disappointing results. Wright has told Wendy's franchisees that the chain's promotions need to better resonate with customers. McDonald's executives have said that too few franchisees offer the under $3 menu as intended, while they also pull back on other promotions, disappointing diners. We have restored our leadership in value and affordability, but that leadership only matters if customers see it, feel it, and believe it each time they visit. McDonald's CEO Chris Kempczinski said in an internal email earlier this month. Burger King last year standardized a menu of two items for $5 or three for $7. Curtis said that the deal's consistency has made it easy for customers to remember. The chain's menu and service need more improvement, Curtis said, but he is hearing promising signs in his chats with customers. It's consistent value and commitment to your premium Whopper lineup that makes the difference here, he said. Next, Hawaii's young people are fleeing paradise. Can tech startups keep them? By Owen Tucker Smith. The seaside streets bear the unmistakable look of a Hawaiian beach town, an oasis of palm trees, swimsuits, and surfboards. Yet tucked behind a cafe where baristas make $11 lattes, young workers write code, design machinery, and operate an industrial laser that can cut through a car door, all in service of the Airform, a heating and cooling system dreamed up by the engineering startup Normal Corporation. Elsewhere on the island of Oahu, students at the University of Hawaii make equipment bound for the moon. In a yurt on a hill overlooking the surf on the North Shore, young scientists create parts on 3D printers for wastewater treatment machines. In a Honolulu basement, engineers make textiles out of chicken feathers. These men and women belong to a band of whip-smart engineers building a manufacturing and technology industry that officials hope will rescue Hawaii from a sagging tourism economy, depressed wages, and an exodus of young residents to the mainland. The flow of inflation-adjusted tourism dollars into Hawaii's economy peaked decades ago. Hawaii, once a premier destination for American and international visitors, has lost traffic to newly popular vacation spots. The number of visitors hasn't rebounded to pre-pandemic levels, and no industry has replaced tourism, much less with higher-paying work. Overall arrivals to the state in June were down 9% compared with the same month in 2019, diminished by a roughly 50% drop in international tourism during that period. Food and housing prices have climbed, while incomes adjusted for the cost of living are among the lowest in the United States. Only California has a higher median home price. Economists say Hawaii needs to shift away from the service-based industry that propelled its explosive growth in the late 20th century. If we don't fix the problem, we're going to face many more years of anemic growth and people voting with their feet, said Carl Bonham, executive director of the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Division. Hawaii has reinvented its economy before, In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the islands depended first on sugar plantations and then the pineapple industry. Waikiki was mostly duck ponds and swampland. Local excitement was limited to the activity of the insect tribes and the occasional fall of a coconut. One early visitor noted, in 1936, Pan American Airways flew passengers from San Francisco to Honolulu for $356, the equivalent of more than $8,000 in today's dollars. After Hawaii became a state in 1959, Pan American began flying newer, larger aircraft that eventually cut airfares in half, putting Hawaii within reach of America's middle class. In a decade, the number of visitors grew sevenfold. During the 1980s, the Japanese economy swelled, drawing legions of new visitors. But by 2000, the volume of inflation-adjusted tourism dollars in Hawaii had peaked. By 2024, Hawaii's economy remained highly dependent on a weakened tourism industry, according to a state report issued last fall. The state needs only to cultivate a few successful enterprises to jumpstart the economy, said Zach Hernandez, who left for college on the mainland and returned to run a talent development startup in Oahu. If you bring 30 or 50 jobs with a $100 billion company, you create 30 or 50 millionaires. You can then invest in more young startups, he said. One possibility is expanding the defense tech sector, he said, taking advantage of Hawaii's strategic position between the U.S. and Asia. Glenn Wakai, a state senator, said new industries would help keep more residents on the islands where they grew up. The people who are leaving Hawaii are the very people we need to stay to reinvent the economy, he said. As those people exit Hawaii, who's going to be left? Greener pastures. Nearly every choice 18-year-old Ariana Thomas made while growing up on Oahu was geared to escape. She worked to improve her grades to apply for colleges on the mainland. As a backup plan, Thomas sought top performances on her volleyball and cross-country teams, thinking she might get recruited. Deep down, I knew I wanted to be somewhere else, she said. Hawaii's never been a tech space. Thomas picked the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, sight unseen. She's a computer science major pursuing a career in data science and machine learning. Hawaii lost a greater share of its population last year than any state except Vermont. Young adults make up roughly a fifth of Hawaii's population, but account for more than 40% of the residents who leave. More than half of Hawaii-born college graduates now live on the mainland. In a nondescript tower in the foothills of the Kualau Mountains, a crew of University of Hawaii students, staff, and faculty hope a local aerospace industry might change that. The students crouch over monitors, assemble flight data, run orbital simulations, wire power systems, and design satellite tracking stations. Our names will be going around the moon, said Matthew Matayag, who found the Hawaii Space Flight Laboratory from a flyer posted in a campus elevator. A high school version of me would not believe what I'm doing. As a practical matter, nearly all these students will likely move to the mainland unless things change, said Miguel Nunes, an aerospace engineer recruited from Portugal to join the project. The best jobs are at SpaceX and other mainland-based companies, he said. State officials have been in talks with Phoenix Space, an orbital launch company based in California that has expressed interest in establishing a launch site on the island. That would be a significant step to building an aerospace industry, according to Nunes. We missed this opportunity, and in 2 years, it's going to be too late, he said. If Hawaii's dreams could be pinned on a single person, it might be Trung Lam. The 45-year-old grew up in Hawaii to Vietnamese immigrant parents who ran a Honolulu sandwich shop. Lamb helped manage the business when he returned to the island after earning a mechanical engineering degree at the University of California, Davis. While working at the family business, Lamb joined a startup that built an app to help people at shopping malls find stores. During the pandemic, he stepped away from the family business to help his children with remote learning. Soon after, he helped start an organization to support local tech workers. Lamb applied to head the Hawaii Technology Development Corporation, a state agency struggling to diversify the local economy. He met with venture capitalists, executives, and lawmakers before aiming his focus on ocean and space-based industries. Convinced that Hawaii could attract founders and investors with its locale close to the equator for easier space launches and surrounded by the Pacific Ocean. The corporation is signing a lease worth more than $1 million for manufacturing space at the Kapaa Industrial Park, a maze of steel buildings on the outskirts of Kailua. The state intends to sublet space to startups that might not have the wherewithal to commit to long-term leases. The project is a test of whether state intervention can stimulate new manufacturing. In meetings of the corporation's board, agency documents show board members question the state's acting as a landlord and the risk of losing public funds. One past effort failed. In 2001, the state began offering 100% tax credits to investors in technology businesses. An audit after the program ended a decade later found the state had afforded nearly $1 billion in tax cuts with little to show for it. Kizo Gates, 41, knows firsthand the challenge of turning ideas into money. He runs an industrial canoe business that he started with high school friends who also grew up in Hawaii. Gates attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, before starting Kamanu Composites, which employs aerospace-grade machinery. The business is in debt, Gates said, and he isn't sure it will survive. We wanted to prove that you can do something different, he said, pacing through his facility at the Kapaa Industrial Park, and I feel like we failed. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 27th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Ken Kuminski. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the New York Times at 9 o'clock. Is Harper's Magazine, and at 10 o'clock is episode number 12 of Daughter of Egypt by Marie Benedict. Stay with us.
If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio Reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. Any questions on Dash's tapes for radio reading? Call us at 716-821-5555. And thanks for caring.
following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.